This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Three young sportsmen have already been named among those who died after the Hawker Hunter T7 jet smashed into the A27 dual carriageway near Brighton and burst into flames. The aircraft crashed onto the dual carriageway on Saturday lunchtime after it failed to pull up after descending from what's known as a loop-the-loop manoeuvre. A huge fireball erupted from the aircraft as it careered 400 metres westwards along the road, crushing cars and setting them ablaze. But when you consider it weighs the best part of 7 tonnes, and it was travelling possibly at around 400 miles an hour, that is a real fireball that struck. Have you ever been to an air show? I have to say that I've only ever been professionally, save for one occasion, when I just started going out with my now ex-wife, and her late father, my late father-in-law, was with a consortium of businessmen who owned an aircraft, and it was a Hunter. But I don't think it didn't look like this one. I don't know if they were different sorts. But anyway, he owned a Hunter, and they had it on display at, it was either the Middle Wallop or Nether Wallop air show, which I think is in Hampshire. I can't remember whether it was Middle Wallop or Nether Wallop. Anyway, so I went down there. Because, you know, you have to be polite when you meet boyfriends or girlfriends or whatever it might be. And, I mean, it wasn't a bad day out, but I kind of wondered why, because it was glorious weather. You sit there in the sun and you just wait. And then suddenly a plane loops on, and then it flies past. I tell you what was impressive. They had a load of helicopters. That was like something out of Apocalypse Now. They suddenly all swooped down in formation, about half a dozen of them. But that was impressive because they moved at a slow speed. So have you ever been to an air show? Let's get some more details on what might, or indeed what might not have happened in the tragedy over Shoreham. Di Whittingham is a former RAF pilot and aviation expert, chief executive of the UK Flight Safety Committee, and joins me now. From what you've seen, read and heard so far, Mr. Whittingham, what do you fear might have happened? Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Well, firstly, it's a huge tragedy, and our sympathies, of course, go out to all those who've lost loved ones and who've been injured. I mean, it's a terrible accident. It's worth remembering, though, that this is the first such accident since the disaster at Farnborough in September 1952. There have been no spectators killed at an air show since that time. And in fact, there's been nobody killed by something dropping on them from above in that time either, all around the UK. Mm. So hugely rare. There have been two injuries, in fact, or one fatality, one injury. One chap hit by a glider. There was a photographer standing on a boundary fence at a competition, and somebody who was hit on an airfield by a piece of rotor blade from 200 yards away. Mm. So, you know, we're talking about hugely rare circumstances. And yes, the air show circuit is enormously popular. People do love to see old aeroplanes and the modern ones flying. And the other reason the Royal Air Force displays is so that we as taxpayers can see what it is that we've paid for.
When you loop the loop, as it's called, Mr. Whittingham, what obviously you have to get your speed right. I would imagine you probably have to get your timing right as well. It's a fairly crucial exercise.
It's a dynamic manoeuvre. I mean, this wasn't actually a straight loop. He was positioning, and it was what you call a quarter clover or a similar manoeuvre where he'd have pulled to the vertical and rolled and used that to do a sort of 270-degree, 90-degree change in direction. You can vary it. So, yes, you start with a pull-up. You apply a certain pitch rate, a certain amount of G, and you need a... all these displays have what they call gates built into them. And as a display pilot, you learn that if you are not inverted at a height, let's say 3,500 feet, you are not going to have room to carry the maneuver all the way through. There's also a speed element to that. You don't want to be too fast, because again, once you point the airplane at the ground, you are going down very fast, and you don't want to be too slow, because you won't have the maneuver speed.
Writing in the Times today, Charles Bremner, who is an aerobatic pilot who you might know or know of, says that he believes that this pilot in this instance simply ran out of height. Does that tally with what you've seen?
Well, he clearly ran out of height because he hit the ground.
Yes. He means with the particular manoeuvre. Maybe, yeah. I don't know, he didn't take it high enough. I'm obviously not a pilot. I've no idea.
It appears that may have been the case. Obviously, the Air Accident Investigation Branch is doing a very careful investigation, and they will look. They've been helped on this occasion by the volume of video footage that has been taken, which will allow them to reconstruct quite accurately. So they will be looking at things like the pitch rate. They'll be looking at speeds to see if they can assess that. And they have some mathematical techniques that will help them there. There'll be some very careful image analysis that will go on. And there are instances, and I've obviously seen the film as well, there are occasions where you wonder how much pitch was being applied to the aeroplane. But there may be reasons for that. You know, there may have been a temporary control restriction. It may have been entirely outside the pilot's control.
And lastly, on the pilot, critically ill, but at the moment, thank the Lord, he has survived. That's incredible when you think he would have hit the ground.
Yeah, unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. And but what it does say is he very nearly got away with it, because it's the rate of descent that tends to finish people off. And the aircraft broke apart, the cockpit section, and
yes,
a manufacturing joint. That came away, and I think that's probably what saved him. Although I have no information on how badly injured he is.
Yes, I think it is pretty severe. Di Whittingham, fascinating speaking with you. Thank you for your time. Former RF pilot and aviation expert, chief executive of the UK Flight Safety Committee. Staying with safety, let's speak with Charles Skira, who's executive of the European Air Show Council. What seems amazing to some people is that manoeuvres or even stunts such as these are not performed over agricultural land or sea. Why would that be? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. Basically, you know, the airports and air bases where a lot of these displays are carried out were put in a lot of World War II bases. And gradually, people are built around them all over the place. So as sort of the population increases, as the building goes around airports, you know, take a look at Heathrow and how that's changed over the years.
Is there not an argument, then, that it should be done over open land or water?
Each area is different. Each area has its own hazards, which will be carefully looked at, not only by the organisers themselves, but also certainly the Civil Aviation Authority, before they grant permissions for those displays to go ahead. Each display has to apply to the CAA and have a risk assessment of the site done. And although there's minimum heights applied, the absolute minimums that are laid down in a document produced by the Civil Aviation Authority, the organisers can then put a further height restriction on certain areas, certain manoeuvres, whether it be a built-up area, it might be masts or other obstructions that are in the local area.
I note that the safety restrictions at the moment require that jets must stay at least 754 feet from the crowd if flying in a straight line. Well, for a jet, that's the blink of an eye, isn't it? Surely it's not far enough.
It all depends, because the manoeuvres, I mean, the guys will practice their displays several times, and it's, you know, sometimes it's a case of how close you come. And like I said, you know, Dive said earlier on, it's 1960, so, sorry, over 60 years since we've had an accident where an aircraft's gone into the crowd, certainly in the UK. Our regulations, and it was all carefully studied, there's a lot of physics and expertise gone into it. There was a study done in the early 90s by Cranfield University as to distances where, how low an aircraft is or what speed it's doing versus the distance to the crowd and the spread of debris, where the debris would go and where it should stop, depending on different heights. So at different lines, that's 754 feet or about 100 metres would be for certain manoeuvres. So probably a straight and level pass. A straight and level pass going down the crowd line some distance away for more high energy manoeuvres where they're coming towards a crowd, it will be a 450 metre line that they can't go past. And that was all decided on, if the aircraft had an incident there where it impacted the ground, the debris spread wouldn't go into the crowd being 450 metres away.
So let me ask you this finally, Mr. Sierra. How safe are air shows?
Fairly safe, yeah. Like I say, everything is risk. There is a risk to them. There's a risk with anything we do. Unfortunately, you know, getting into a car and going to the shop to get some milk
sure,
is a bit more risk than you are going to any air show at all. Because statistically, you're more likely to be involved in a road traffic collision than you are in any flying-related activity.
As those poor souls on that dual carriageway found out, of course, when a plane landed on them. Charles Skira, thank you. You're executive of the European Air Show Council. Dave's at Heathrow. Do you ever go to air shows, Dave?
Yes, quite a bit, Nick. Anyway, good morning.
Good morning.
I was actually at Shoreham when the accident happened on Saturday.
Oh, really?
It was a shocking, horrific experience.
Right.
And many people in the crowd were openly crying and screaming.
Yes.
And it was... you know, I can imagine a lot of people will be suffering post-traumatic stress after this.
Tell me what you saw.
Well, I was actually following the aircraft with my camera. I've got a telephoto lens on the camera. And,
so have I seen your footage on the television?
No, I haven't sent it to the TV. I've sent mine to the accident investigation branch for them.
Right. Don't want to make it public?
No, because I was very close to the accident. Although I was in the airfield quite safely.
So tell me what you filmed.
Well, I filmed the actual impact, the aircraft going down behind the trees, and the fireball afterwards. So I've got good pictures of the aircraft just before it crashed, and you can see the control surfaces quite clearly.
Sorry, the control surfaces?
Yes, you can see the position of the control surfaces in my pictures. So I'm sure the accident investigators will be looking at that. I might also add that the aircraft was intact before the crash. No pieces had fallen off, you know, and it was an old aircraft.
So as you track it all the way down, presumably. Have you got it at the top of the loop?
Yeah.
And then you track it?
I have. Yes, I have, yeah. And you can see the wing flaps are actually down at the top of the loop.
Sorry, I don't know whether that's good or bad. Are they meant to be down?
I don't know.
I see. Okay, right. But as you're tracking it, and you've got it pretty constantly...
I didn't think anything was wrong. It wasn't...
No.
...down below the tree. I mean, it looked fairly normal manoeuvre to me.
No, you're just filming it because it's a thrilling manoeuvre and you want to capture...
Yeah, absolutely. Like most people, if you go to these air shows, Nick, you see hundreds of people there with all this expensive camera kit, and I'm no different. I've got the expensive gear.
Yes.
That's why I've got the photos, so...
And as it's coming down, does it seem to strike a bird? Is there a flare-out from...
No, I think the engine was making normal noises. I didn't hear the engine surging, which is popping, you know, backfiring. Wasn't doing anything like that. It sounded completely normal to me. I can't say what sort of power the engine was developing. That's, you know, that will be down to the pilot, really. Only he will know that.
And presumably you don't get the actual point of impact because it's masked by trees, is it?
Yes, yeah, but the fireball spread for 300 to 400 yards.
Good
past
Lord.
Me. And, you know, that's the sort of speed he was going. I would say he was going between 300 and 400 miles an hour when he hit the ground.
And did it look as though he was almost... One of my contributors, who wasn't there and is only going by really informed guesswork, looked as though he might almost have pulled it off, and that's possibly why the cockpit survived.
Yeah, I think if it had another couple of hundred feet of airspace, he probably would have got away with it.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
I am of a generation where people used to smoke at work. I know for some... No, it couldn't possibly be true. And my late dad, sadly, late as a result of lung cancer as well, my late dad worked in a newspaper office where there was a fug, that's F-U-G, the smoke that would hang over the newsroom, particularly as it got close to when the presses rolled, which at the old Daily Mirror when it was at Holborn Circus was around between 4 and 4.30 in the afternoon. You would actually feel the building shake because there were 11 floors above ground and there were 3 floors below ground that would have these giant rolls. If you can imagine what an elephant's toilet roll would look like, that is what those huge rolls of print would be. And they would come in each day. The lorries would be backed up Bouverie Street, Fleet Street, Carmelite Street, Holborn Circus, Ludgate Hill, just giant! And then those presses would start to rumble, and you had to hit the deadline. And it's a high-pressure industry working in papers. You've got to get that story, we've got to... Imagine, and I appreciate I'm talking about very grim circumstances, but if the Shoreham story... We've got to commit to a figure. Is it 10? Is it 11? You've just got to... People shouting at each other, and just... puffing away. Now, I'm not pretending it's the only high-pressure job. Of course it's not. Jobs that you're in. Advertising. All sorts of industries. Call centres, imagine being a call. How wonderful, then, to be able to vape. What the hell's that, Nick? To use an e-cigarette to ease the tension, not to have to go out in the pouring rain or huddle like in a bus shelter to have a vape. Is that the way forward? Well, there seems to be growing acceptance of vaping, doesn't there? Just last week, Public Health England said that 95%, cigarettes were 95% less harmful than the tobacco alternative. And now the Chartered Institute of Environmental Health is saying bosses should allow employees to vape at their desks. And possibly, you know, I suppose, vape in their factories. Good idea or not? Let's speak with Hazel Cheeseman, who's Director of Policy at ASH, Action on Smoking and Health, who joins me now. Yes or no, Hazel Cheeseman? Good morning.
Good morning. Well, yes and no, I suppose. I think our view is that vaping and smoking are different, whereas being exposed to secondhand smoke is quite dangerous. Being exposed to vapour doesn't appear at the moment to confer any harm at all. So having kind of national legislation in the same way as we do with tobacco smoke isn't appropriate. And it's up to employers to decide, you know, is this an environment where we want people to vape? Does it annoy others?
That's a difficult one, though, isn't it? Because let's say I'm running a newspaper, because I have actually a newsroom, and everybody's happy, and then we employ a new person as our health correspondent or as our motoring correspondent, or he or she is actively against vaping. What am I going to do then?
Well, I guess that's not a unique situation for an employer, sure. Is it? That there are things which some employees do that others find irritating.
So democracy rules. I have a vote. My 20 reporters, I'm sorry, chum, 19-1, we're carrying on vaping.
Well, I mean, I think that the important thing to remember is what we're not talking about here is a health harm. You know, there is no evidence that being exposed to somebody else's vapour is going to do you harm. Though there is evidence to suggest that it might be helping that person to quit smoking and avoid, you know, acquiring a disease in the future.
Well, and also combat stress, of course.
Well, you know, there's two sides to that coin, because, you know, a nicotine addiction also perpetuates stress as well. So, you know, quitting altogether might
have you ever smoked
stress completely. Pardon?
Have you ever smoked?
I have, yes.
Yeah. Do you smoke currently?
I don't know.
No. But there are some people who I'm sure you know, and for all the wrong reasons, but they think they need that cigarette in highly stressful circumstances. Because
yeah,
they just need
absolutely.
That.
And people experience, you know, it relieves their cravings, it relieves stress, absolutely, and that experience is.
Stay where we are. I'll come back to you in a second. Let's bring a doctor in. Dr. Dawn Harper is the TV doctor, of course, from Channel 4's Embarrassing Body. And let's get the view of one of the medical profession to vape or not to vape in the workplace. Morning, doctor.
Good morning. Well, my view is very much that e-cigarettes are certainly safer than smoking cigarettes. But I would like to see them regulated before we routinely allow them to be smoked in the workplace. And by that, I mean, we know that if we're using pharmaceutically pure nicotine, and we can ensure, because there's been some studies that show there have been very low levels of hydrocarbons shown in e-cigarette smoke when we've been looking at room environments, so that's where the research is being done. Those levels, to be honest, there is no evidence as yet that they could be harmful to the human, but I think what we need to do is make sure that the e-cigarettes are conforming to those standards. So at the moment, there is no regulation. I think that's going to come in board very, very soon. It has to. And actually, bottom line is I'm a fan of e-cigarettes. What we do know...
Define a fan, Dawn. What do you mean by a fan?
Well,
do you use them?
I don't use them, but I certainly talk to my patients about them. The thinking being this, that it's not the nicotine in a cigarette that kills you. It's the 4,000 other toxins. And the secondhand smoke from cigarettes, the main damage is what we call the side stream smoke. So it's not necessarily the exhaled smoke, where a lot of the damaging particles have actually been inhaled into the human lung. It's the side stream smoke that is constantly being let loose as the cigarette is just lying idle. You don't get any side stream smoke from an e-cigarette, and you don't have all the other toxins. There have been, I think, a couple of studies. One study showed some chromium in one brand of an e-cigarette, but mostly we are looking at very safe products. And certainly something that I am very, very happy. We've got 2.6 million vaping users in the UK today. I would like to see that number doubled, quite frankly, because smoking kills 100,000 people in the UK every year. So we know, and I was pleased to see Public Health England come out last week and say it is 95% healthier, safer than smoking. What I would like to see, though, is I'd like to see the whole industry regulated so that people know what they're getting and we know that they are as safe as we think they are.
Dawn, thank you. Dr. Dawn Harper, TV doctor from Channel 4's Embarrassing Bodies. Last word for now from Hazel Cheeseman. I remind you, Director of Policy at ASH. What is the ASH view on e-cigarettes, Hazel Cheeseman?
Well, very much in line with what Dawn was saying there. You know, it's much safer than smoking. They appear to be helping people to quit. You know, if we can, as Dawn said, if we could double the number of people who were moving away from smoking and towards vaping tomorrow, that would be a fantastic step forward.
Thanks for that. Hazel Cheeseman is Director of Policy Action on Smoking and Health, otherwise known as ASH. Let's take your calls on that particularly. Do you know what my heart would go out to? Imagine if you've just managed to beat smoking and you were quite a heavy smoker, say a packet a day, say 20-odd a day or something like that, and you're there and you've done it, and you go into a workplace where you can vape. Vaping is allowed. This is a vape workplace. And someone opposite you is puffing away on that. You're going to, oh, man alive. I could really do with one of those cigarettes. And you're just looking at that person for 7, 8, 9 hours a day. Alan's in Woking. Alan?
Yeah, hi there. I've been in an office environment where people have vaped. I used to smoke 30 years ago as well. And it's not so much the fact that they're smoking, but it's the residual effect. After about half a day, I had a splitting headache, and a really bad taste in my mouth. Because
why? How close were you to the, geographically, not emotionally, how close were you to the person who vaped?
A six-person room, about, 4 metres away, I guess.
Could you smell something then?
Absolutely.
Could you?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's like a bubblegum smell that they have. They have all these.
Do they give out a smell? I know they give out flavours, so that actually gives out a strawberry smell. And that,
it does, but then it sticks in your mouth afterwards. So, like, you're walking around and you're thinking, what's this thing in your mouth? And then half a day through the day, I've got a splitting headache.
Yeah, sure.
Why have I got a splitting headache? Well, obviously, I'm absorbing this.
So you're still working there then, Alan, or have you changed jobs?
Well, we had a word. We share it with another company. We had a word with that company, and they changed their policy, and they stopped vaping.
That may be the way forward. Alan, thank you. I knew they gave those folks, because I think that's a bit odd. This is the one thing I have against the... Well, there's a few things I have against the e-cigarette companies, but the idea that people want them in bubblegum flavour and melon and cherry. You're just doing that to get kids. Be honest about this. This is the reality of it. But I didn't realise... Because those smells sometimes with those... It's just sort of a sugary... icky smell, isn't it? Barry's in Warsaw. To vape or not vape in a workplace? Barry, Warsaw. Hello, Barry.
Ooh, hello, mate. I'm looking for a job. I'm joking.
You're bringing the load back in the boot of the car, are you, Barry?
Yeah, absolutely. £1,000 a time. Have some of that. But I'm definitely in favour of it. In fact, if I could add a stimulant to them, I'd supply them free of charge. I'd double my production in my shoe factory.
Do you allow... Because you make dancing shoes. That's right. Do you allow vaping at your place?
At the moment, no one's vaping. They're just going outside for the tea break and lunch break and smoking. I don't know if any walking away from their workplace.
So you would allow... Remind me how many staff you employ.
45.
And they've all been with you for about 80 years because you're such a good boss. I remember that. So you would allow vaping?
That was 75. And I said, you've got to retire at 60. But I didn't even know her age. She was 75, still working for me.
Thank you for that, Barry. Tony's in New Malden. You're on the radio, Tony.
Hi, Nick.
What are you going to tell me?
Well, I run an e-cigarette company, Volcano.
Oh, yes.
And I'd like to take issue with your statement that we have flavours to attract children.
Yes,
absolutely
you do.
Not the case.
Yes, you do. Why would you do a bubblegum flavour?
Are you asserting that adults don't like sweet flavours?
Tony, why would you do cherry?
Because, well, we do a cherry lava, because a lot of adults, my wife absolutely loves cherries. People like cherry. And if you look at the statistics, the facts, the research, it is that children effectively, other than in a tiny, tiny instance, are not using e-cigarettes as a gateway to smoking. They're not taking up vaping from scratch. It just doesn't happen. So you can't say that adults don't like those flavours. We've got 30-odd different flavours. And
all right, but aren't you trying to attract people who don't smoke into vaping then?
No, that's absolutely not.
But I mean, I don't smoke, but the idea that I could trade a Peter Stuyvesant, if it still exists, or a Marlboro or a Silk Cut, if I'm right, for bubblegum flavour vaping, it just seems ludicrous to me, Tony. Am I wrong?
Well, it would. If you use bubblegum and like the flavour, why not? And then it's more attractive for you to get that smoking alternative, which the very best scientists and research say is 95%, at least 95% safer than smoking tobacco.
Good luck. I'll allow you to name your company one last time, Tony.
It's Volcano e-cigarettes.
Is it going well?
It's going pretty well, and we're an ethical company. And just if you want to talk about vaping in the workplace, the whole point is that any employer, any owner of a private space is entirely at liberty to allow or bar vaping if they so wish.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
There is a major problem regarding sex offences on trains. This says the British Transport Police BTP report figures showing the incidents have risen by 25% to record levels. Wholly unacceptable. But is the answer, as one person who hopefully, or sorry, in his view, hopefully, most likely, I should say, will be the leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, is the answer, as he would seem to be supporting, the idea of women-only rail carriages? Really? shouldn't we actually be tackling the problem rather than effectively giving in and saying, yeah, it's something we can't solve, we should just make sure that women are safer? Is that really the way forward? Well, I'll take your views in just a second. Let's get first to LBC reporter Simon Conway. He's been speaking with passengers at one of London's busiest stations, Charing Cross. What are they saying, Simon?
Morning, Nick. Yes, growing concern about sexual harassment on public transport. Recent figures, as you say, suggested attacks had increased by a quarter. So is Jeremy Corbyn's idea of women-only carriages at night time a way to deal with this? They already do it in countries like Japan, India and Brazil. It's a controversial one, as I've been finding out from passengers here this morning.
Sounds like a good idea.
Do you think lots of women would feel more confident about getting the train if they were in a women-only carriage?
I would, yeah, definitely.
What would make you feel more confident about it?
That you haven't got, you know, the potential risk of being sexually assaulted or harassed.
Late at night, yeah, I agree, but during the day, it's fine.
Would it make you feel safer?
At night, yeah, definitely.
I'm not particularly in favour of it, because I think it actually then would accentuate the fact that all the women are in one place. So if there were to be an issue, then they'd know exactly where women were going to be getting off the train, more so than the safety on the train. So I think I'd be more concerned about on the platforms and at the stations than I would be once I'm actually on a train.
OK, do you feel at risk when you travel at, you know, at night?
Not at all, no.
No, I don't think it's safe in the fact that if there is a potential rapist or mugger, that he would probably feel safer that it's just women. If you're in a mixed carriage, you might get other men that would come to your assistance that would help you.
I think it's a good idea.
Tell me why.
Because it keeps safer, especially when people go out and drink. I think, you know, they get more vulnerable, you know, that for someone to come and assault them. So for me, I think it's a good idea.
So a clear divide amongst women as to whether this idea would work. Interestingly, most of the men I've spoken to don't seem to have a problem with being told, sorry, mate, you can't get on this carriage, you're a bloke.
Simon Conway, thank you. Reporting there from Charing Cross. Jeremy Corbyn says, my intention would be to make public transport safer for everyone. Well, I'm sure we'd all agree with that. He goes on to say, I would consult with women and open it up to hear their views on whether women-only carriages would be welcome. Well, let's find out. You can have your say in just a second, but to give us some pointers for our conversation, Sarah Green is with the End Violence Against Women Coalition and joins me now. So the idea, how does it strike you, Sarah Green? Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I think it's a terrible idea. Jeremy Corbyn isn't completely committed to it, as your reporter said. He said he'll look at it and consult on it. It's a terrible idea because, as you said in your introduction, really, it implies that this is now the zone for women and, therefore, perhaps harassment in the mixed carriages is somehow more acceptable or more likely. So it's changing women's behaviour and conduct in order to solve a problem where, really, we need to tackle the small number of men who perpetrate these this behaviour.
I'm pleased to say I can agree with you, because is this not another way of looking at it, Ms Green, is that this is just normalising unacceptable and indeed illegal behaviour?
Yeah, it accepts it as inevitable, as something we can't do anything about, so we'll bundle the women over here. What is interesting about it is Jeremy Corbyn's using figures from the British Transport Police to kind of recognise that this is important and that really matters, which is great and great to have it talked about. But he's using figures from a project that's been going on for a couple of years on British Transport Police, which started in London, which has actually done some really effective work. Again, as your reporter said, it's increased reporting of the offences because lots of women previously thought there's not even any point telling anybody about this. It's not taken seriously.
And they've Was that really the sentiment then? There's no point reporting it because they won't listen to us. Was that really what it was like as a woman, do you think?
Yes.
That's terrible.
Comparable with other sexual violence crimes. So that's the same at the you know, much worse end of the scale as well. What British Transport Police have found effective is things like doing really good police training, transport staff training, and really good CCTV operator training and a more focused use of CCTV to kind of spot regular offenders and then gather the evidence for dealing with them.
So just lastly, is it your belief then, Ms Green, that it is being reported more, that's why there's this spike, or it is occurring more and that also fuels the spike?
We can't know for sure. It's very likely it's being reported more, which again goes across sexual offences. So more serious crimes of sexual violence are also massively up on reporting. And that's because actually of deep social and cultural changes that are happening around recognising that this stuff is criminal, and that women shouldn't have to put up with it, and that they can talk to somebody and report if they want to.
Sarah Green, you're with End Violence Against Women Coalition. Thank you for your input. To Peter's in Staplehurst. Peter, as a bloke, we'll start with you. What do you think about these women-only carriages at certain times, sometimes at night?
I think I'm against it. In France, they'd had women-only carriages. When that terrorist went through the carriage, he wouldn't have met a couple of big American Marines who overpowered him.
What an interesting point.
He had about 200 rounds of ammo.
He did.
He could have easily wiped out the whole carriage.
Yeah. And so had he chosen a soft target like the female-only, the whole lot would have gone down, possibly.
Yeah.
That's a very... What a clever... Sorry. Clever observation. Clever idea. Clever observation. Thank you. Let's speak with a woman, Audrey in Sanderstead. Audrey, I don't know how often you use the trains, but how would you feel about this idea?
No, I don't travel at all, I have to say. But when I travelled years ago, going back to London to work, we used to have a choice. We had a ladies' carriage only, no smoking, and a general carriage.
Hmm.
Now, what's wrong with that?
What a lady? Well, that's what I'm asking you. Why do you like the idea of a lady's carriage? I appreciate it's very rare that Moroccan gunmen burst out of toilets with machine guns and start shooting everybody, but possibly putting a group of women who are more vulnerable together. Is there not actually an added danger in that?
Yes, I agree with you. And when I think a young lady came on, she said she would like to have a ladies only carriage at night. Now, I really do agree with that. I was on train with my husband, and we had a really nasty fit. And it was really loud, and shops throwing cans all over the place and everything like that. And it was just frightening.
Yeah, I wonder how full they'd be. I wonder how much use we would actually get out of them, lastly, Audrey.
That's the point. I mean, I can't say, because I'm totally blind. I think you know. You said my guide dog.
Mm.
And, you know, I haven't travelled on a train now, only when my son takes me or my daughter takes me.
Yeah.
But during the day, yes, it's a general thing. You've just got to get whatever carriage you can. But at night, that might be a consideration.
Thank you for that. Tony Doyle, what if there's one woman in a woman-only carriage late at night? She then wouldn't have much protection. Well, indeed, Mr. Doyle, she'd almost be a target, wouldn't she? Martin Blackstone, it's not a good idea. It will just cause confusion and provide greater focus on the issue. For safer transport, increase the police presence. I would have thought that's